Today is January 23rd. We're looking at adrenal information. Excuse me, page 14. So we've talked about the whole adrenal gland before. We know the adrenal gland is actually two different tissue types. There's an outermost portion called the adrenal what? Good, and it makes what types or what classes of hormones? They're steroids, right. And we know that the innermost portion of your adrenal gland is actually nervous tissue, and it's called what? Medulla, yeah. So you can see in this picture a really clear distinction between the innermost tissue and that outer region, that cortex, that makes up the outside of our adrenal gland. So the adrenal medulla, because it's nervous tissue, actually works for your autonomic nervous system. I know this has taken you way back into Bio 210, but if you recall, the autonomic nervous system is an automatic nervous system. And that automatic nervous system controls involuntary muscles and glands and organs, something that is beyond your conscious control, to an extent. So there were two branches of your ANS that you may have discussed before. There was a parasympathetic and a sympathetic branch that you may have heard about. Which one of those two branches released adrenaline, which is otherwise known as epinephrine, and noradrenaline?
Sympathetic.
Sympathetic, right. Well, there's actually nervous tissue here that works for that autonomic nervous system, sympathetic branch, and the adrenal medulla releases both adrenaline, which is epinephrine, and of course, norepinephrine or noradrenaline. Because it is nervous tissue, we know that those chemicals can work as neurotransmitters, basically traveling from one nerve cell to a neighboring cell. Maybe it's a nerve cell, maybe it's a muscle cell. But if these chemicals get in the bloodstream, we don't call them neurotransmitters. What do we call them? We now call them hormones, right? So epinephrine and norepinephrine can behave as both neurotransmitters when they operate between cells, and they can behave as hormones, which is what this medulla is dumping into the bloodstream. Nervous tissue's making the hormones, and of course they hitch a ride in the bloodstream at that point. So it's not necessarily the fast-acting portion of the ANS here, because once you get adrenaline and noradrenaline into your bloodstream, they can drift for about 30 minutes. So even if somebody scares you and, you know, you feel that fight or flight response immediately, it takes about 30 minutes for your liver to metabolize and break down and get rid of those hormones out of the bloodstream. So the effects do linger far more than they would if they were just sitting at a neurotransmitter between cells. All right, so just to remind you, the two hormones produced here are epinephrine and norepinephrine. The alternate name for epinephrine is adrenaline. Norepinephrine's alternate name is noradrenaline. They do have different receptors in the body. I don't want to imply that they're twins and do the exact same thing. They actually have slightly different effects depending on what target they are going for or what receptor binds them. But for our conversation, together they bring about a host of responses that are called the fight or flight response. You may have recalled hearing about this in Bio 210. When you're under fight or flight control, how do you feel?
Nervous,
anxiety. Are you wide awake or sleepy?
Wide
awake. How about your heart rate?
Racing.
Your breathing rate?
Fast
goes up, yeah. And your bronchial passageways dilate, which means they get
wider,
yeah. So that way you can take in more oxygen. So it's all about giving oxygen to your body. We actually break down glucose. And so we're giving our bodies the ATP that's needed to do either a fight or make a run for it in a flight. You'll notice that what we decrease here are the non-essential activities. We don't necessarily need to have the last meal being digested if it's the last thing we ever do. So the GI activity decreases. And what are we decreasing here? What is diuresis?
Urination.
Urination, right. So we decrease the processing of blood to make urine. So again, that's not critical to be done if it is a life or death experience. All right. So these two hormones, adrenaline and noradrenaline, are actually under neural control, meaning your autonomic nervous system or brain, hypothalamus, will trigger their release from the adrenal medulla. And of course, if you're under constant state of stress, then you may be constantly secreting those two hormones into your bloodstream, which can increase your blood pressure and heart rate and increase your blood glucose. So interesting that there are now more hormones added to our list that increase blood glucose. We talked on Tuesday about cortisol increasing blood glucose. Now we know this duo here, epinephrine and norepinephrine, increase blood glucose. So, you know, when we talk about high blood sugar levels, we really have to know what the underlying issue is. You know, is somebody nervous? Is somebody looking at a pancreatic issue? Is it an adrenal issue? So, a lot of stuff going on here. Okay, so just a way for us to kind of pause and review, which one of these lowers blood pressure? Yeah, atrial natriuretic peptide, or ANP. That one is the only one on this list that lowers blood pressure. Norepinephrine, epinephrine, we just did those. Those both increase pressure. So does ADH, so does aldosterone. So that's got to be a pretty potent hormone, ANP, if it's going to battle the effects of these other hormones. So would you consider ANP a synergist to the others on the list or an antagonist? Good. Meaning what? Working against, right. All right, looks like we're ready for page 15. Do y'all have any questions so far? I mentioned a couple of days ago that the thyroid gland was our only truly pure endocrine gland, meaning the only thing your thyroid gland does is make hormones. The pancreas is not just an endocrine gland, it's also an exocrine gland. That exocrine portion, you know, normally we talked about being things like sweat glands and oil glands that secrete to your skin surface. But these tubes that you see running through the middle of that pancreas, they carry pancreatic juices into the small intestine, which ultimately can be excreted to the outside of your body in feces. So, you know, we do have an exocrine portion here, part of the digestive system. We'll save that discussion until later. We're going to focus only on the portion of your pancreas that plays a role in endocrine function. So if we were looking for your pancreas, where would we find it?
Behind the stomach.
Behind the stomach, good. You may have heard of the peritoneum before, or mesentery. It is sitting partially embedded in that mesentery. It is linked right up against that small intestine, and you're right, it is correctly situated behind the stomach. Some describe it as a triangular-shaped gland. It looks kind of like a tongue in this picture, but nonetheless, it is going to hook right into that small intestine for its digestive functions. We know, though, that hormones don't necessarily need to get to the digestive system. How do all hormones travel?
Bloodstream.
Bloodstream, right. So the endocrine function here is related to a link into that bloodstream. In this picture, I know there's tiny words hard to read, but what I'm looking at is this tube here. That's actually part of the digestive function or exocrine function. We'll leave that alone for now. That's not really our focus. What we're instead going to focus on are these little clusters of cells. There's a few there, there's a few there. They're all embedded throughout this pancreatic tissue. And if we were to draw that in and look closer, these little clusters of cells are called the islet cells. Okay? And so the islet cells are the ones secreting insulin and glucagon. The islet cells are actually two forms. You know, there's an alpha form and a beta form of these islet cells. The alpha cells specifically release one type of hormone. The beta cells specifically release another type. On your worksheet, you'll notice the beta cells release glucagon, or sorry, the beta cells release insulin, the alpha cells release glucagon. So different hormones produced by the different sets of cells there. Okay, so insulin is produced by beta. Glucagon is produced by the alpha cells. Notice their jobs are antagonistic, meaning they do what? Opposite. Good. You'll notice that insulin lowers blood glucose levels and glucagon raises blood glucose levels. Okay, these two hormones operate under humoral control. That means that blood glucose concentrations will drive the release of one or the other of these two hormones. All right, so let me go back to this picture for just a moment. The pancreas itself is the regulatory center for blood glucose levels. The pancreas is the one monitoring blood glucose levels, and the pancreas will release either insulin or glucagon depending on what those blood glucose levels are. You know, it's kind of like the thermostat in your home. Your thermostat regulates whether or not the heat should cut on in the wintertime. So if the thermostat is broken, does your heat work? Nope. So if your pancreas is not able to sense or regulate blood glucose levels, what happens to your blood glucose levels?
They're crazy.
They're crazy, exactly. So keeping in mind that your brain doesn't regulate everything, the pancreas here is actually the one that regulates blood glucose levels. It is the regulatory center in a negative feedback loop that helps to maintain blood sugar levels. But it's not just insulin and glucagon that are playing a role here. We've got, we just learned about epinephrine, right, and norepinephrine. Cortisol also plays a role. So there's a lot more going on than just the two hormones coming from this one. All right, so if you don't have properly working pancreatic cells that can sense the levels of blood glucose, then we end up with a form of diabetes called diabetes mellitus. So that's really where we're looking for this problem coming from. It's either the sensory mechanism's not working right, there might be insulin resistance, the cells may be underproducing insulin, or even your bodily cells may be resistant to receiving that insulin. So let me tell you a little bit more about what insulin does. Let me go back to the screen. You'll notice that insulin lowers blood glucose levels. So if you're lowering blood glucose levels, that means you're getting the glucose out of the bloodstream. One thing insulin can do is take that glucose to a cell and say, hey cell, you can use this glucose to make something really cool. What is it?
ATP.
ATP. So insulin can help put that glucose into our cells. Those cells then can turn around and make ATP. How do you feel when you've had a lot of glucose in your bloodstream?
Yeehaw.
You're energetic, right? So as long as insulin is carrying that glucose to your cells and you're making ATP, you know, sometimes you feel like you can climb a skyscraper, bare hands and all, right? So as long as glucose is being given to those cells, you feel energy because that, of course, is what we do with that excess glucose. But sometimes there is so much glucose in your bloodstream that your cells are like, I'm full, thanks, no more, you know, and there's not a way to get all that glucose into those cells. So insulin can also take glucose to your liver. It's like taking it home to mama and saying, here, I got this for you. And so what does the liver do with that extra glucose?
Builds glycogen.
Builds glycogen, good. So we can hang on to that glycogen for a few days. Your muscles can also store that glycogen for a few days. And of course, if you need the glycogen to be turned back into glucose, it's an easy transformation. So in this reaction here of taking glucose and turning it into glycogen, which hormone drives that mechanism?
Insulin.
So I'm just going to put a reminder up here that when we do this, when we take glucose out of the bloodstream and we turn it into a long linked molecule called glycogen, we're actually taking it and lowering that blood glucose level. And that's our goal here, is to lower blood glucose. So I need to tell you a secret we did not tell you in Bio 210. You've probably heard 1,000 times that water follows salt, right? Okay, we did not tell you, but water follows sugar too. So when you have glucose in your bloodstream, what happens to the fluids in your surrounding cells and tissues? Where do they like to go?
With the sugar.
With the sugar, because sugar and salt are the life of the party. What are the two things people crave? You either crave salty foods or you crave sweet foods, right? And both of those attract water. So if you've got extra sugar in your bloodstream, then water is going to follow that sugar just the same way it follows salt. So you say, well, why is it so important to get all this extra sugar out of the bloodstream? Because your cells and tissues release their water, the water follows that sugar, and eventually it ends up in your kidneys. And what do your kidneys do with all this extra water and sugar? Pee it out. And then now how do you feel?
Tired.
Because you just lost your sugars, right? And you're also now thirsty because you just peed out your water, so you're dehydrated. So this is why we've got to hide the sugar. We got to get it out of the bloodstream. Otherwise, you're going to lose both sugar and water when that blood flows to your kidneys. So the way we get rid of that extra sugar is we force it into your cells and say, hey, quick, make ATP out of this. And then we take it to our liver and our muscles, and we store it there as glycogen. So when we store it in the liver and muscles, it's not attracting water. And so, of course, that helps us to maintain blood sugar levels and keep that water in our bodies where it's supposed to be. There is a fancy name for making glycogen, and on your worksheet, in that little chart, it is bold-faced. You'll notice the fancy name for it is glycogenesis. You say, oh my gosh, what a word. I can't emphasize enough to use your word roots here. Glycogenesis literally has the word glycogen in there, and it has the word genesis in there. Glycogen, we know what that is. It's a polysaccharide. It is the storage form of glucose. And genesis means to do what?
Create or make.
Create or make, right. Literally, glycogen, genesis, means to create or make glycogen. Okay, so it's better to just break the word down than to simply memorize what that word means. So insulin has a big job, and as we age, your pancreas may not produce as much insulin as it used to, or your cells may become resistant to insulin and say, oh, you're here all the time with that sugar, and you know, we don't need any more sugar, and so they're less open to taking in that sugar when insulin arrives with glucose. So as we get older, if you have something like a pancreas that's not producing enough sugar, or your cells aren't receptive to it, then that's when we start running into these diabetes mellitus problems. All right, so let's talk about the antagonist over here. The antagonist that works directly against insulin is what? Glucagon, okay? I know you lead stressful lifestyles. You're a student. I'm sure you probably have other obligations in your life, maybe jobs, maybe kids, or family obligations. And because we have all these hats that we wear, you may not be able to eat on a routine basis. If you're not eating on a routine basis, then your blood sugar levels may not be fed constantly with an intake of food. So if you do need sugar, and you need it right now to stay alive, where can you get sugar from the most easiest accessible form? You can get it from glycogen. Sorry, I'm going to get those words confused here. Glycogen, and where do you store it?
In the
liver. Liver and muscles, right. So if you haven't been eating for several hours, maybe it's just been a hectic, busy day, you don't have enough blood glucose to fuel your ATP production, your body says, well, here's the next best place to get some sugar from. Go to your liver and muscles, break down that glycogen. When you break it down, it turns back into glucose. Okay? So glucagon is the one that mediates that process. Does glucagon raise blood sugar or lower blood sugar?
Raises.
It raises it. There's a fancy name for this one too. You'll notice on your sheet it has a lysis ending. In fact, it's called glycogenolysis, but hey, if you break the word down, it's got glycogen and lysis in there, meaning what?
Metabolism.
Yeah, we're going to break down, rupture, split. We're going to burn down that glycogen and turn it into glucose. Okay, so fancy name here is glycogenolysis. Sure.
So what would happen if your pancreas wasn't working properly?
It depends. If you've got a type 1 diabetic, it could be that it's a congenital issue. That means that their beta cells never produced enough insulin, or maybe none at all. But if it's later in life, then we probably say it's a type 2 diabetic, which means that when somebody says the pancreas isn't working and you're talking about diabetes, I'm assuming those islet cells, specifically the beta cells, aren't working. Maybe they're not producing enough insulin, or maybe somebody has insulin resistance in their cells. So the cells just say, there has to be more insulin to get the sugar in, and there's just not enough to lower the blood sugar levels.
So what is, in the case of someone having pancreatic cancer, is that a...
That is most likely, I'm going to go back to this picture here. Those epithelial cells that line this ductwork here can become cancerous. And because they're epithelial, we know that they tend to regenerate rather quickly. So that's where the cancer comes from. So it tends to be in that ductwork. And you're not necessarily the islet cells for the diabetes would form. All right. So these two hormones work against each other. Kind of think of them like a seesaw. We want to maintain blood sugar between a narrow range. Do you happen to know what that range should be for a person who hasn't eaten in about 8 hours? So the range is typically around 70 to 120. There are units there. I'm not going to bother with the units. So to break this down number-wise, what if your glucose is 180?
Too much sugar.
Too much sugar. And which hormone should turn on?
Insulin.
Insulin, yeah. So this is greater than 180. Sorry, greater than 120. Yes, if you're 130, 180, if you're 300, if you're 500, insulin should be the hormone to turn on to lower that blood sugar. What's the low end cutoff for turning on glucagon? Yeah, turn it on when you're less than 70. Now, to wrap this back into what we covered in class on Tuesday, there is another hormone here that can play a role. I do want to mention that glucose can store as glycogen, which is a polysaccharide, for around 3 days. We can store it in your liver and muscles for about that length of time. After that length of time, your body transports that glycogen to our fatty tissues and transforms it into fat or triglyceride. So if you're looking to burn off fat, you have to burn your available glucose supplies. You then have to burn through your available glycogen supplies in your liver and muscles, and then you now can start tapping into the fat supplies. So that's why you really want to make sure that if you've eaten extra calories, you burn them off, because once it gets to be fat, you now have an extra step to go to burn it back off. So what is the hormone that can turn around and break down that fat into sugar if you need it?
Cortisol.
That's cortisol. I'm going to make a real big loop here, bring it back around. Nowadays, people have more access to food than they ever did in the past. In the past, you know, if you think about food availability, somebody might not have had a meal every single day, or maybe not even every other day. If they had any fat supplies, the body would tap the glucose levels first, then the glycogen would be burned off, and then it would tap into the fat supplies, and the fat can then be turned down into glucose. That, unfortunately, is a messy process. It is I would call it a dirty process, because in breaking down the fats and the proteins in your body, we can release a nasty little byproduct called ketones. And so ketones indicate that we're in this fat and protein breakdown mode. I specifically avoided writing the word proteins up here because we cannot store glycogen as a protein. We can only store excess levels as fat. But when you're breaking down fat by way of cortisol, you may also be breaking down proteins. So cortisol will do both fat and protein breakdown. When you break down proteins, you're using those amino acids to make other things in your body. Okay, so let me repeat. Extra glucose is only stored as either glycogen or as fat. Extra glucose is not stored as protein. But when you turn around and start breaking this stuff down, you can break down both fats and proteins using cortisol. It is only the fat, though, that gives rise to some extra sugar if you're breaking that stuff down. The reason I made this point is because if you are strict dieting, you're really crash dieting, you're limiting your calorie intake, then your body will not only break down fat to make glucose, it will also break down healthy lean muscle, which is protein, to make glucose. If you do not in turn burn that glucose off, you go back around the cycle again. So take your fats and your proteins, break it down to glucose. If you have too much glucose, how is it then stored? Back to glycogen and then back to fat. So you can take lean, healthy muscle, turn it into glucose, which is then stored ultimately as fat. That is a vicious cycle if somebody's crash dieting and limiting calorie intake, and that's how you never lose weight. So you simply exchange your healthy muscle tissue for fat tissue. So that's a pretty nasty little side effect if the way cortisol works. But does it make sense why your body would want to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Famine mode. Famine mode, right. Because if you're not eating and you're not ultimately saving any extra calories as fat, what's going to happen to a person? Gone, dead, right? So this is a way to preserve the body, you know, even if it means breaking down healthy lean muscle tissue. Okay, so of all the hormones we've talked about today, which is the only one that lowers blood glucose levels?
Insulin.
Insulin, good. And how do you store extra glucose in your body? As glycogen, right, and ultimately as fat. There's two different hormones that work here that raise blood glucose. If you're breaking down glycogen to make glucose, which hormone is at play? Glucagon, right? And if you're using cortisol to break down fat to make glucose, now you're using cortisol. So that's going to be fat breaking down into that sugar. Just a reminder of this term we talked about in class on Tuesday, gluconeogenesis. Use the neo as a great clue here because we normally don't think of fat as a source of sugars, but if you do break it down, like I mentioned, it's a dirty process. We can ultimately produce some sugars from that process. I'm going to jot the word ketones up here. And the reason I want to mention ketones one more time is for this. If someone is trying to break down fat reserves and they do a urinary test, like a dipstick in the urine, if they've got ketones in there, what does that tell us about their dieting process? So if you are dieting, you're trying to lose weight, and you pee on a dipstick, and you've got ketones in your urine, what does that tell us you're breaking down?
Fats.
So if you're dieting and you're trying to lose weight, that's where you want to be, right? Is breaking down those fats. And so that says to the person who's dieting, then you've burned through glucose, you've burned through glycogen, and now you're tapping fat supplies. Should that person be able to lose weight?
Yes.
They should, right? Okay, as long as they don't break down too much fat and have it stored back as fat, ultimately. So we got to hit that sweet spot in there for breaking down the fat. Now, if you're a diabetic, that's a totally different story. Diabetics who test their urine and have ketones in the urine, again, means they're breaking down fats. The problem with that is they may be eating normally. In fact, their blood sugar may be fine. Their blood sugar may be high. In fact, the reality is their blood sugar probably is high. So where is blood sugar monitored in the body? In the pancreas, right. So if the pancreas fails as a monitor for blood sugar, then the pancreas may fail to produce enough what?
Insulin.
Right. So if the pancreas doesn't monitor blood sugar like it's supposed to, and then it doesn't produce and release enough insulin in response, what can continue happening to your blood sugar levels?
They'll go up.
They'll go up. And if this mechanism is broken, then your body may be breaking down fats due to cortisol. So this whole mechanism gets out of whack. It's supposed to be like the perfect seesaw where you're sitting right even. But if you've got diabetes, that seesaw is going crazy. Okay, so that means that your blood sugar levels can't be regulated because the pancreas is likely not monitoring or releasing enough sugar, or insulin like it's supposed to. So since we're on the topic of diabetes, let's head there for just a moment. About halfway down page 15 is diabetes mellitus. In adults with type 2 diabetes, it's typically going to be hyposecretion of insulin by the beta cells, or the cells of the body may have become insulin resistant. So that description there is strictly for a type 2 type diabetic. Now, for any type of diabetic who's type 1 or type 2, the three cardinal signs or symptoms are polyuria, polydipsia, and polyphagia. So let's take those one by one. What is polyuria?
Excessive urination.
Excessive urination. Good. And polyphagia?
Hungry,
excessive eating. And dipsia?
Thirsty,
right. So it goes back to having too much blood sugar in the bloodstream. Like we talked, you know, if you've got too much blood sugar, water follows salt, water also follows sugar. And so when your kidneys get all this extra sugar in the water coming along with it, your kidneys say, whoa, this is too much, flush it out, you lose it in your urine. So there goes the sugar that you were going to use to make ATP, and there goes the fluids that were going to keep you hydrated. So ultimately, by peeing out extra fluids, polyuria, we are now hungry and thirsty to replace our lost fluids and our lost sugars. So those three symptoms right there can be explained by flushing out excess sugar and excess fluids into your urine. Other symptoms that can come along with diabetes is nausea and vomiting from having blood sugar levels out of whack. Type 1 diabetics, more so than type 2, may have a condition called ketoacidosis. Keto sounds familiar, right? Ketones, okay? So that comes from breaking down those fats. You ever smelled someone's breath with ketoacidosis? Mm-hmm. Anybody want to share what it smells like?
Garbage.
Okay. Rotten apple juice,
yeah. Yeah, it is unlike any odor you will smell coming from someone's breath. It is unlike a food that they've ever eaten. It is not like, you know, alcohol. It is like a rotten soured, like a fruit juice smell. It's a really unmistakable odor that you will never forget once you've smelled ketoacidosis. But when you know that you smelled ketoacidosis, then you say, ah, this person must be breaking down fats to produce their blood sugar. And if they've got diabetes, it doesn't mean their blood sugar is low. It means their pancreas isn't monitoring correctly, and they may have sky-high blood sugar. So unfortunately, the kidneys get worn out doing this, and the only way to get rid of some of these toxins is through your respiratory system. So that's why a person is going to exhale out those toxins from their breath. This is not scientific. This is just, if you don't have a glucose meter to test somebody's blood, you know, high blood sugar can mean that a person feels hot, maybe their skin is dry. Sometimes people with low blood sugar may have cold, clammy skin. There's some really cool stuff coming out on the market nowadays. I don't know if you've paid attention to all the new glucose meters. You know, they've even got tattoos that will change color for somebody who's got high blood sugar, so, you know, they know to get the insulin. So there's a lot of things that are coming down the line with this. There are even beta cell implants that they are testing with that would replenish somebody's pancreas with functional beta cells if, in fact, their pancreas has faulty or dysfunctional beta cells. So it would be great if we could see in the future that we could eliminate this condition altogether just with having healthy beta cells implanted into a pancreas. Long-term damage includes eye damage like blindness. We see heart damage, heart being worn out, kidney failure, limb amputations. We see neuropathy, which is nerve damage in the feet, especially in the legs. So unfortunately, this left untreated can result in life-altering damage. The two types here, like I mentioned, type 1 is congenital. It is treated only by insulin. Type 2 diabetics, we typically say that's a lifestyle or perhaps a diet issue, and that's how we try to fix it, is through diet and exercise. Type 2 diabetics may end up being reliant on pills that control the blood sugar or even insulin dependent. But if someone is only insulin dependent and has been that way since, you know, childhood, that is a type 1 diabetic. I do want to mention that type 1 diabetes is hard to catch. Sometimes you may have a child who's, you know, grumpy all the time and doesn't have a lot of energy, or maybe their energy level's yo-yo. There have been kids that have had diabetes their entire life and aren't diagnosed until they're 18 years of age. So, you know, just, it's not something that rears its head and says, I'm diabetes, I'm type 1, you know, look out for me. It is something that you kind of have to be diligent in catching, like with a lot of these endocrine issues. All right, so here's a summary of the types of diabetes down at the bottom of your page. So what does it mean to be a type 1 diabetic? You don't make insulin. And were you born with this condition?
Yeah.
You were born with this condition, that's right. Okay, so even if you're not diagnosed until you're an adult, if you're insulin dependent, then you probably were born with it. So we call it IDDM, or juvenile diabetes, even though if you're born with it, you're gonna have it for as long as you live. But congenital meaning you're born with this condition. Type 2 diabetes, what can cause a person to have type 2? Insulin intolerance,
their diet,
their poor diet, right?
Yeah,
starchy carby, yeah. No exercise, couch potato. Some of us have jobs that just don't lend themselves to keeping healthy, you know? So diet and exercise can lead to, or the lack thereof, type 2 diabetes. And that's how they're often controlled, is through weight loss, through modifying diet and exercise. Type 2 may or may not be insulin dependent. It depends on how severe or how much trouble it is to maintain that normal blood sugar level. Women can have gestational diabetes that can form during pregnancy. They do a glucose tolerance test during pregnancy to see if mom may be, you know, a gestational diabetic. It does increase the risk for diabetes later in life, but it's not a guarantee that mom will form type 2 diabetes later in life. All right. So I'll leave this up here for you just to read through. And are there any questions, anything I can address once again on page 15? story. We've known about diabetes mellitus for at least 2,000 years. The word mellitus means honey. And of course, that's the inclination of something being sweet. And it's a really gross story because the way the Greeks discovered this form of diabetes was by tasting urine. Yuck. I would not want to be the official taste tester for diabetes. Seriously. It must not have known how to ask. Well, urine's sterile for 24 hours, but after that.
Still.
Still, yeah.
You're not poster or not interested.
The nether regions produce this, nope. So these are commonly confused. I want to make sure we hit these again. We did talk about diabetes insipidus the other day. This is a hyposecretion of ADH. Diabetes mellitus is a hyposecretion of insulin or perhaps insulin-resistant cells. So if you don't have enough ADH, you don't retain enough what?
Water.
Right. Okay, so if you don't make enough ADH, the problem is you don't retain enough water. If you don't make enough insulin, your blood sugar is too high. So if you don't retain enough water, then you basically drink and pee. That's your routine. So too much urination is called
polyuria,
and frequent thirst is called
polydipsia.
Yeah, that's it. That's only two symptoms. So the big problem for a person with the insipidus form is going to be a risk of dehydration. There's actually three classic signs or symptoms of diabetes mellitus besides having high blood sugar. We expect to see, once again, polyuria and polydipsia. And one more poly. Which one is this one? Polyphagia. Just going to make a note here that polyphagia is not something you have in diabetes insipidus, okay, because we're not peeing out sugar. Note here that polyphagia is the one symptom you have with mellitus that you don't have with insipidus. Okay, do people with insipidus have any blood sugar problems? No blood sugar issues here. It is just a water coming in, water going out problem. This, however, this mellitus issue, that's where you've got the blood sugar that's playing a role. So that's where we're going to see the dehydration plus other things, long-term complications can evolve here. I hope this helps make these two clear. These are commonly confused. Just a little bit left, and that's going to be over on page 16. All right, so you probably learned pineal gland back in Bio 210. It is a small structure in the deep parts of our brain. And this particular little gland makes a hormone that helps us to regulate our sleep and wake cycles. You may notice where it's situated. You know, the thalamus is like right in here, and the hypothalamus is below. It is right nearby. And so we know that the thalamus does also play a role in sleep and wake cycles. So it seems to make sense that we have the pineal gland or body sitting right next door. This particular gland is going to regulate levels of melatonin. That is the hormone that it produces to help maintain our sleep and our wake cycles. So when do you expect to have the highest levels of melatonin?
At night.
At night, right. So, of course, it drives the sleepiness that we expect to see. Interesting that it also drives, we think, sex drives. We think it may play roles in, you know, our biorhythms, you know, like female menstrual cycles to some extent. We think that it does play a role in animal coats. You know, sometimes animals are white to match the snow in the winter and brown to match the landscape in the summer. So we think that melatonin drives that, which is really cool. We also think it plays a role in the shorter winter days causing seasonal affective disorder. You know, people get depressed sometimes in the wintertime. So a lot of interesting stuff here going on with melatonin. It's really hard to research, right? Because it's in the brain. But, you know, this is a hormone that we do know regulates sleep and wake cycles. All right, so, you know, most recently you can see in 2017, that's just 3 years ago, there was a Nobel Prize awarded for some work with melatonin, you know, how it makes us go through this daily cycle of being awake and exposed to bright light and asleep at the nighttime. If you work a night shift, you're fighting melatonin production because bright light reduces melatonin and low levels of light or darkness increase the levels. So, you know, as hard as you may try to get used to a night shift and sleeping in the daytime, you're fighting this natural hormone production. Last one on our list here is thymus gland. Take a look. Right here around the trachea is our thyroid gland. Kind of looks like a little bow tie. But further down, right here over the heart, that's where the thymus gland is found. They're easily confused because they sit close to each other. Now, interesting thing about your thymus, it tends to disappear and atrophy during your later teenage years. So if you're into your early 20s, you probably have a shriveled up little teeny tiny thymus gland sitting right there over your heart. So we know that it's important for programming our immune system early in life. And once your programming has been taken care of, then obviously the body says, well, that job's done. We don't really need that thymus gland as much after, you know, late adolescence. So you say, well, hey, what happens if I'm 35 years old and I get introduced to, say, a new virus or new bacterium? How does my body build immunity if this is where you're programming immunity? There's another T location, your tonsils. You have other glands in your body or places like lymph nodes. There is some training that goes on for those white blood cells in those locations. So that's one good reason to hang on to your tonsils if you can. They kind of serve as a adult training ground, you might say, for where those immune cells, those white blood cells can be trained.
It's, the tonsils thing, like when I was growing up, everybody had their tonsils taken out before they were like, six or seven.
Right.
But I mean, now they found out what it doesn't affect what heard something on the other day. Like, they're not saying that it would do you harm to get your tonsils taken out when you're young, but, like, they're saying that if you leave your tonsils in, that it did, like, basically they're saying, I got my tonsils taken out or nothing.
Right. I mean, the only, I think the driving force behind it is, like, are they kissing? Are they blocking your airway?
My daughter snored so bad, hers had to come out.
Oh, wow.
It was scary. She was 12.
So yeah, if you're doing that where you're blocking airway, I think that's probably a cause for it. But if you just get repeated tonsillitis, I think nowadays they're trying to find other ways to treat that so that a person can keep their tonsils. If you have had them taken out, there are other places in your body where you can train your immune cells, but that is a major place where they can be trained because of everything that comes past your throat and your mouth.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
We had a cool doctor. He didn't take my tonsils out. He cultured my throat, found out I had staph that was causing the tonsillitis,
ooh,
not a regular cold. He left my tonsils.
Well, that was staph. Thank you for him, because, you know, that saved you the surgery of having them taken out. And, you know, they say that the older you are, the more likely you can rupture blood vessels back there because of the way the body is set up. So, yeah, scary stuff. Hey, that is it for endocrine, so
yay.
Just a few minutes on blood typing, just to kind of wet your whistle, and then that'll be all our time today. So there are practice sheets on 17, 18, and 19. There should be answers and D2Ls announcements. I will double check to make sure those are showing up for you. And then starting on page 22 is blood. On the D2L announcements at the very bottom of the announcement, if it's not there, I'll post it for you.
Okay.
Or I can email it to you, either one. It is up there?
Oh, I'm not sure. I didn't see it.
Okay.
I say I was trying to see these charts.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're good now that you're done, so. So I know you guys have done blood typing in lab, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So what's your comfort level? Not quite there yet. The way you do it in lab is a little different perspective than the way I do it in here, but I think after hearing it there and hearing it here, it'll start to kind of come together and make hopefully better sense. I do want to tell you there's some really awesome resources out there. This Nobel Prize game here, they will basically say, hey, we've got this patient, blood type them. They take a stick and do their blood typing. And then they say, their blood type's A negative. Give them a blood bag. They need a blood bag. So you've got like all these blood bags to pick from, and you might pick O positive, and it goes, eh. And so you have to do another one until you get it right. And it'll keep popping patients at you until you know really well who gets what kind of blood type and transfusions. The Red Cross has some games. It's also good, and Get Body Smart. All these are free websites to use. If you just need to practice up and feel comfortable with doing donations and who can receive, who can donate, that whole business, these are really great to use. If you guys find something else that's helpful out there, please pass it along. I'll be happy to post it on D2L and share with everybody. All right, so what I'm going to do is not look at PowerPoint for just a minute. We're going to talk about my little show and tell here and talk about blood types for just a few moments. Completely unrelated to blood types, let's talk about flu, okay? So it is flu season. If you happen to have an illness and you go and you get tested and they say, bad news, you have the flu, you've been tested positive for that flu virus, right? Okay, so if you've just been feeling bad and they test you and they say, great news, you're negative, what does that mean?
Not the flu.
Got something else maybe, but not the flu. So I want to harp on the positive versus negative for just a minute. If you've got something, you're positive for it.
Like a pregnancy test.
Like a pregnancy test. That's a good one. Comes at plus, right? You got the pregnancy. If you're negative, you don't have it. Okay. So, you know, each of us has some blood type. And besides, there's like 40 different blood types. Thank God we're not doing all those, right? There are a couple of major ones that we focus on. One is the ABO blood group, and the other is that RH factor, which, you know, either you've got it or you don't. So I want to talk to you about blood types, meaning you have something versus you don't. Now, in terms of our ABO blood groups, there are two things that you can have. You can have an antigen called the A antigen, and you can have an antigen called the B antigen. So if I have the A antigen, then I'm positive for it. That's what I've got. That's what I am. I'm A. If I've got the B antigen, then I'm positive for it. That's what I've got. That's what I display on my blood, or red blood cell surface. When you have an antigen that makes your blood type, your blood cell proudly displays it like my little blue dots here and says, I'm A. It wears it and says, I'm A. That's what I am. See what I've got. Look at my antigen. I'm A. And that's what it wears all the time, is this antigen on its surface. Any of you all B? Okay? If your blood type is B, then your red blood cells wear an antigen on the surface. It sticks out and it says, hey, I'm the B antigen. So everywhere it goes, it proudly displays, I'm the B antigen. Okay? If you are AB, any of y'all AB? I bet quite a few of you are AB. It's very common. If you have both antigens, then you wear both of those proteins on your red blood cell surface, and your cell circulates around going, I've got both. I got both the A antigen and the B antigen. What if you have none? O. Okay, so O says, I don't have any antigens. So it's negative for the A antigen and the B antigen. It has nothing. So it's O. So you see it has nothing on the surface of the cell to identify it. So it kind of is in stealth mode, right? Okay? So these are antibodies. They're Y-shaped. Your white blood cells make these antibodies. Now, your white blood cells are checking you out all the time. You didn't know that, did you? They are sniffing around you, checking you out every hour of every day to see if everything in your body should be there. And if it finds something that shouldn't be there, then these antibodies will fight these foreign objects and get rid of them. So flu is something that's going to trigger an antibody to come and fight, right? Okay, so let's do this. I'm blood type A. Do I need antibodies to fight myself?
No.
No point, right? Because that would kill a person. So my white blood cells come along and sniff and say, yep, that looks like us. That's great, good to go. No need to bother those red blood cells. So my red blood cells continue to circulate with no harm, no foul. Here's the issue. Do my white blood cells recognize this antigen? They say, hey, wait a minute. That doesn't look like us. We recognize this one, but we don't recognize this foreign antigen. So the one that is my own, I'm going to call a self-antigen. It looks like me, it smells like me, it acts like me. My white blood cells say it's me. It's okay, it's me. All right, so that's mine. That's a self-antigen. I got this one in a transfusion, and my white blood cells say, whoa, doesn't look right. That looks crazy foreign. That is a foreign antigen. Okay, so an antigen is kind of like an identifier on the blood cell's surface. And it can be perceived as foreign. The self one, of course, I don't need to perceive as foreign. It's my own. But my white blood cells identify this one as being something that we don't need in our bodies. So what do my white blood cells do to this one? Attack it. Help it on out. You're getting out of here, right? So these Y-shaped antibodies are produced. So it's kind of like the white blood cells are circulating. They're checking these out, and they say, whoa, you're not supposed to be here. We don't recognize you. And they send the hitman. They send the antibodies. And the antibodies come, and they bind, and they attack that white, or this red blood cell, and they clump it up. So there may be multiples. There may be one attached here. There may be another one attached over here. And so I start getting this lattice work of all of these red blood cells that are anchored by these antibodies. Well, the next thing you know, let's put another one in the mix. I may have all these red blood cells circulating that are anchored by these antibodies. And your body's going to filter this through your kidneys, and your kidneys are going to try to get rid of this big old clump. So unfortunately, if you have a clump like this going through the tiny capillaries of your kidneys, what could happen to your kidneys?
Clot
them up, yeah. So we don't want to get in the situation where we've got this clump of red blood cells heading to our kidneys to be filtered out, because it could cause kidney damage, loss of hemoglobin and other things into our urine. So let me repeat. Let's do another example. Now let's do this one. Let's say that your blood type is B. Okay? White blood cells, check it out. Everything's great. That's mine. It smells like me, looks like me. White blood cells say, no need to bother that, right? And then along comes this blood type in a transfusion. This one's AB. Is this okay?
No.
Why not?
The A.
So why is the A bad?
Because it's foreign to you.
It's foreign, yeah. So I can recognize the B antigen because it's part of me. It's something that I produce and my body says is okay. But that A antigen, you're right, is foreign. So even though it has the B on there, it's the A part that triggers a red flag. So what happens to this foreign blood type?
Antibodies jump on it,
and they, of course, bind that A antigen, and they clump this blood up, and they send it to your kidneys to be discarded in your urine. The process of having an antibody attack an antigen is another A word. It's called agglutination. Okay, so like I mentioned earlier, you can have this lattice effect where an antibody will actually bind two different red blood cells, and you start getting this big clump of cells flowing through your bloodstream. And then, yeah, that can cause kidney damage. Okay, so an antigen could be yourself, right? When could an antigen be considered foreign?
When it doesn't match,
when it's not your self antigen, okay? So let's do another example. This time my blood type is O. Do I have any antigens?
No.
No antigens. My white blood cells circulate around that and say, yep, that looks like me, smells like me, there's nothing on the red blood cell surface, that's great. And then along comes a transfusion and I get this. Have I seen this before, this A antigen? So now what happens? Antibodies jump on it, and we got agglutination, right? Okay, so if you've got a foreign antigen being introduced into your body, then that's when we have a problem. Let's work it this way. Let's say my blood type is AB. I've got antigen A, I've got antigen B. My body says that's okay. Along comes a blood type, and I've got antigen A on this donor cell now being introduced into my body. Have I seen that antigen before?
Yes.
Am I okay to receive this blood?
Yes.
Yeah. Do I need antibodies to come and attack this blood?
No.
Because it's not foreign, right? There's nothing foreign about that A antigen. I've got it. I've seen it. Your body says, hey, this is cool. This is something we can accept. So if you've seen the antigen, then you can receive it. But if you haven't seen the antigen, something different, you can't get it. Okay, so let's do another one. Let's do this. Let's say my blood type is B. Okay, I've seen the B antigen. That's the only thing on the cell surface. And I'm going to give you this one. Anything on the cell surface?
No.
So when I get this, my white blood cells come check it out and they say, nothing there. So is there anything to fight on the cell surface?
No.
So there are no anti-O antibodies because there are no antigens associated with an O blood type. So that's part of the reason why O is considered a universal donor. You can give it to pretty much anybody since there's no antigens on that cell surface. Okay, just a couple of things here about this. Antigens can cause agglutination if they're foreign. So if I haven't seen it, and I'm talking about your specific body, if you haven't seen it before, you can't get it in a transfusion. Antibodies are made by white blood cells. It's their job to fight off those foreign antigens. So if you've got an invader, a foreign type in your body, that's when we're going to have those antibodies attack. And by the way, this is page 29. So to review, antigens may be self if they're common to you. They can be foreign if you've never seen them before. Antibodies can only fight foreign antigens. If we do have an antibody attack and bind to an antigen that's foreign, that clumping process is known as agglutination. Okay, so clumping is known as agglutination. And these antigens I'm talking about, they're actually like little chains that stick up off the surface of your red blood cell. So when your white blood cells drift past, they're checking out this glycocalyx, this external structure out here. And they say, yep, everything looks good, looks like us. And so they keep on passing by. It's when you get a foreign substance sticking off one of those cells is when we start to sniff around and say, you know, maybe we need some of those Y-shaped antibodies to come along and clump. All right, so on your worksheet there, middle of the page, we're actually talking right now about the ABO blood group. There's four blood types, AB, and O. Okay, and the only two antigens that are part of this group are antigen A and B. You got it. So what blood type are you if you have no antigens?
O.
You're O. Good. AB means your blood type is AB. So if you've got both antigen A and antigen B, then your blood type is AB. What if you've just got antigen A?
A.
B.
If my antigen is A, it is A.
Yeah.
So the antigen is how you identify it. Like if your last name is Smith, then your last name is Smith. So if your antigen is A, then that's your blood type, right? It is face value what you give. If your antigen is B, you have blood type B. We need to talk a little more, and we'll do this on Tuesday, about what it means to be a universal donor and a universal recipient. We know the universal donor is O, recipient is AB, but there's actually more to this story than meets the eye. So there's a background that we need to talk about. I encourage you to play one of the games between now and Tuesday. We'll hit this again, 29, on Tuesday, and then we'll go back and cover some material from the beginning of that chapter.